From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Hey, and welcome to another edition of the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, our own unique brew of news, information, and game show tributes. You're going to want to stick around for that. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. It's Tuesday, September 18th. Our first time doing the show in the actual
AM.
Sort of wee small. It's not that wee or that small hour of the morning, but it sure feels early to me.
So well, it was wee at 4:15 when the alarm went off.
That's right. This is good. We're getting all around. And you guys all seem so happy to be here. So
we like the morning. Rachel and I do anyway.
Three of you.
Okay. We'll get you over to the light side, Luke. Hey, on the show today, big news story involving one of the biggest contractors in Iraq, Blackwater USA, the Iraqi government revoking the license of the security contractor. There was a shootout over the weekend. At least 9 Iraqi civilians died. We'll dig into the story.
And let's see, a boom of building in China, meth addiction in the U.S. How are these two things conspiring to cancel high school football games in Arizona?
The connection, thin copper wire.
That's right. We'll explain coming up later.
All right. There's a website called marryourdaughter.com if you're looking for a young bride. You have about $19,000. This website might be for you. Before you call the cops, though, there's more to this story. Yeah. We'll tell you about it.
And also, a game show icon passed away recently, Brett Summers. She was best known probably for her kind of ribald quips on the Match game. We're going to honor her memory with blank.
Very nice.
Do you have something slightly entendre to put in there?
I got to work on that one.
Okay.
The coffee hasn't really coursed through the veins just yet.
All right. We'll get today's headlines from our newscaster, Rachel Martin, in just a minute. First, though, here is the BPP's big story.
The Iraqi Interior Ministry has announced it would revoke the license of the private security contractor Blackwater USA. The immediate reason? The shooting death of at least 9 Iraqi civilians when the contractors were protecting U.S. diplomats.
Earlier this morning, we spoke to an Iraqi who lives right near where this incident took place. He actually knows one of the civilians who was killed. We're going to call him Yusuf to protect his identity. Here's how he described what happened.
A bomb went off near a convoy of SUVs belonging to the Blackwater company. And then they started, the personnel started to shoot on rampage on people. And near them there was a camp of Iraqi army. And the Iraqi army thought that there are some people who are shooting against them. So there will be a clash between the two sides, the Blackwater personnel and the Iraqi army. And there were many people on the streets were killed due to that, to what happened.
The Iraqis say they will prosecute the Blackwater employees involved in the shooting, which took place on Sunday in Baghdad, although questions exist over whether or not such a prosecution is even possible.
Now, the United States State Department acknowledges that innocent civilians were killed, but says the reaction was appropriate because the American convoy had been attacked. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki yesterday to express regret and to pledge cooperation in preventing similar incidents in the future.
And Blackwater actually went a step further than the State Department. Ann Tyrell, a company spokeswoman, said in an email message, quote, "The civilians reportedly fired upon by Blackwater professionals were in fact armed enemies. Blackwater personnel returned defensive fire. Blackwater professionals heroically defended American lives in a war zone."
The story has brought up a whole bunch of questions about private security contractors in general and Blackwater in particular. We're going to get into that in more detail in just a moment when we talk to Bill Sizemore from the Virginia Pilot newspaper. He's been following the Blackwater story for years. And that's the Bryant Park Project's big story. Now here's Rachel Martin with the rest of the day's news.
This is NPR.
Hi, everyone. The most recent O.J. Simpson saga continues. Las Vegas police have arrested a third suspect in connection with last week's alleged armed robbery of sports memorabilia at a Vegas hotel. O.J. Simpson and two other men have been arrested for allegedly breaking into the Palace Station Hotel and confiscating items including books and photographs signed by the former NFL star. But Simpson says no guns were involved and he was only trying to retrieve items that had been stolen from him. Prosecutors said they expect to file charges against Simpson and the other defendants within the next few days. Meanwhile, the 60-year-old Simpson is being held at the Clark County Jail in Las Vegas. And after 3 days of testifying about her alleged rape, a key witness in the trial of a polygamous sect leader in Utah was cross-examined by defense lawyers yesterday. The woman has alleged that Warren Jeffs, the president of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, coerced her into marrying her 19-year-old cousin when she was 14 years old. Jeffs is on trial for 2 counts of rape as an accomplice. Jurors last week heard emotional testimony from the woman who said she sobbed through her wedding and tried to kill herself after she and her cousin had sex for the first time. But defense attorney Tara Isaacson asked the woman why, if she thought she was being raped, did she never tell anyone?
Isn't it true that you never told your mother that you were being raped? You told the police that you partially blame your mother for your marriage.
Yes, I do.
You didn't tell your friends I'm being raped, is that right?
Who likes to tell anyone they're being raped?
Okay, I'm just asking the question.
Isaacson tried to portray the girl's cousin as a loving husband who was trying to make the marriage work. He has not been charged. And starting tomorrow, readers of the New York Times will no longer have to shell out money to read articles by high-profile columnists and reporters. Yesterday, the Times announced it will end its paid Times Select web service and make most of its web content available for free. The website started charging people 2 years ago, $7.95 a month or about $50 a year, to read articles by the likes of Maureen Dowd and Thomas Friedman. The move to free up this content is an acknowledgement by the Times that making people pay to read would not bring in as much money as making it available for free and supporting it with advertising dollars. I'm Rachel Martin. The news is always online at npr.org. Luke and Allison, back to you.
You know what's so meta about that story?
What?
That is the most blog story at the New York Times.
They're probably psyched because now they don't have to pay to read their own stuff.
A collective cheer went up in the BPP newsroom.
I'm sure the writers at the Times are happy too, just that more people can read. You know, you write something, you want as many people as possible to see it, and this will only increase that. So I'm sure everyone's happy except an accountant somewhere in the bowels of the old gray lady.
Rachel Martin, thanks for the news.
You're welcome.
All right, we're going to take a couple minutes here to get further into today's big story, the Iraqi government's revoking of the security contract Blackwater USA's license to operate in the country. This comes after Blackwater contractors in an American diplomatic convoy were involved in a shootout on Sunday in which at least 9 Iraqis were killed. We've got Bill Sizemore on the line. He's a reporter for the Virginia Pilot newspaper. He co-wrote a 6-part series on Blackwater that was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. Hi, Bill.
Hi there.
So the Iraqi government now says that it's revoking Blackwater's license. Does that mean that these Blackwater guys have to leave Iraq immediately? Is that the end of the story?
No, that's probably not even the beginning of the story. They clearly won't be leaving immediately, and whether they leave at all, I would say, is open to question. It's not even clear that they have a license from the Iraqi government or that such a license is needed for what they do over there. It's all very murky, but the one thing that seems clear to me is that the Iraqi government is not necessarily driving the bus here.
Well, one of the things that they have said they're also going to do is prosecute these guys. If they don't have they may not have a license to pull, but can they prosecute them?
That's very much open to question as well. It's very unclear whether these guys are subject to any law.
Seriously? I mean, these are guys who are – how many of them roughly are we talking about in Iraq, just in general and also specifically from Blackwater?
Blackwater has about 1,000 armed contractors in Iraq. They work for the State Department under a diplomatic security contract protecting our diplomats.
And just for people who maybe aren't that familiar with them, describe who these guys are and sort of what their tendencies seem to be.
They are, for the most part, former military. Many of them are from the various special forces units of the military, Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, that sort of thing, which means they're pretty highly trained, pretty highly skilled. They got out of the military, and they had these skills that weren't very marketable in the in the regular world, and so they gravitated to companies like Blackwater.
But now they're basically on security details and other things in Iraq. They're armed. They're you know, sometimes shooting people, and it's not clear who actually they have to answer to.
That's right. The Iraqis say they want to prosecute them under Iraqi law. Well, that doesn't seem to be legally possible, from what I can tell. Back when Paul Bremer was the head of state, the provisional head of state in the first year of the occupation, he issued an order which exempts private contractors from Iraqi law for anything they do in the course of carrying out their duties, and that order has never been rescinded.
And by the way, as I understand it, the sort of big coup for Blackwater, which was not a giant company before this war started, was that they got the contract to protect this guy, Jerry Bremer.
That's right, and that's really what led to their getting the State Department contracts after Bremer left. They just sort of picked up where they left off.
And Bill, this sounds very cloak and dagger and below the radar line, but in terms of Blackwater's involvement with Iraqi civilians, do they do any good?
Do they do any good, did you say?
Yeah, for Iraqi civilians. Do they protect Iraqis in any way? Do they make it a safer, more stable place?
That's not their job.
But even though it's not their job, does it happen as an unintended consequence?
I think if you, you know, I'm not in Baghdad, but I think if you asked Iraqis on the street, you would get just the opposite reaction. There have been a number of allegations of these guys firing at and killing Iraqi civilians. For instance, people who drive too close to their convoys. People at intersections. There was an incident last Christmas Eve in the Green Zone in which a Blackwater contractor shot and killed an Iraqi bodyguard, a bodyguard to the vice president of Iraq.
Well, actually, you know what? Speaking of sort of the average Iraqi, we as we heard in the intro to the show, actually talked to somebody on the phone this morning in Iraq. We're going to call him Yusuf. Here's what he told us, and this is just his opinion about how Iraqis feel about contractors like Blackwater.
In general, there's a sense of resentment against them because, I mean, people are afraid when they see this kind of convoys walking or driving near them because, I mean, those people are licensed to kill. The contractors are licensed to kill. And they have the license to kill anybody without being questioned. I mean, every Iraqi is expecting to be shot by one of them. So, I mean, it's a good gesture from the government to withdraw their license because, I mean, we feel that a great danger will remove them from the street.
Is this, you think, is a huge fight shaping up between the U.S. and the Iraqi government on this right now?
Well, I think the U.S. is trying its best to defuse that. As you reported, Secretary Rice called the prime minister and expressed regret and said that the U.S. is going to investigate, et cetera, et cetera. I think they very much hope that they can find a middle ground here and defuse this thing. The U.S. Tells us that Iraq is a sovereign government, which presumably means that they should have the power and authority to do something like throw a company out of the country if they feel that's justified. But the reality is that the State Department doesn't want to see Blackwater booted out of the country because they depend on Blackwater for their security. You know, these are the guys that that keep them safe, the guys that drive them around, and Blackwater is very, very proud of the fact that they've never lost one of their what they call the noun, the or the principal, the people that they protect, the dignitaries that they protect.
Can I just ask a last quick question here, Bill? When I was in New Orleans after Katrina, Blackwater was there protecting a lot of areas. I wondered, do you know, are they they're not allowed to shoot people in the U.S., are they? I mean, what are the rules when they're in America?
Well, the rules are determined by their client. That's the short answer. I mean, certainly they've never, to my knowledge, they've never been accused of shooting at anybody in the United States. But you know, they do. It's their client that determines what their rules of engagement are. And in the case of Iraq, it's the State Department.
We'll see what happens because you know the State Department is a big player over there, but they're also being protected by Blackwater. So it'll be interesting to see. Bill Sizemore, reporter for the Virginia Pilot newspaper. Thank you so much. We're going to put a link on our blog to your series on Blackwater, which was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. Thanks again.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park. Hey, everybody, I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. Allison, are you ready at this early hour of the morning to do some rambling?
I am. I'm all limbered up.
Okay, let's ramble then.
Clothing impresario Mark Echo wants you to decide what to do with Barry Bonds' 756th home run ball. See, he's the guy who won the ball in the eBay auction. He paid over $700,000 for it. Now he's got this website up where you, or I, or anybody else, can vote on what to do with the ball. You can send it to the Baseball Hall of Fame. You can imprint an asterisk on it and then send it to Cooperstown. Or C, you can blast it into space on a rocket. Here's Echo on the Today Show yesterday explaining.
What this is about is a moment where all of our collective opinion, our collective consciousness.
And why does that matter?
Because that's what I stand for.
That's what he stands for. By the way, he voted for the asterisk.
You know what's great about being a millionaire like that guy is? It said in the paper, one story about it, said it's not clear if Echo's planning to buy a rocket ship. But it seems like it's a reasonable possibility he might just buy a rocket ship, too. All right. More news on a growing menace to both fashion and personal safety. Crocs, those foam clog shoes, may be dangerous when worn on escalators. Now, remember, on this very show, we talked about a Texas hospital. I think it was in Texas, where they banned them from the surgical.
It was
surgical. In the U.K. Oh, golly. Well, anyway, U.K., Texas. A hospital in the U.K. banned them from the surgery room. And now the Japanese government has issued a warning to escalator riders saying that Crocs.
Surgery room? How about an operating room?
Operating room, surgery room, Texas, tomato, tomato. Let's just keep it moving. Japanese government says that if you are wearing Crocs, they could get snagged in the teeth or the sides of the escalators, causing injury. In Washington, D.C., the metro system now also posts a warning to passengers wearing Crocs. And in late August, a Virginia boy nearly lost his big toenail on a shopping mall escalator. He was wearing Crocs.
Hey, you know, it's a Tuesday. It means new album releases for the day.
Mm-hmm. Emmylou Harris, Babyface, James Blunt, James Murphy, LCD Sound System. the happiest I've ever seen Matt Martinez when he's directing the show. That's LCD's off of LCD's new album, which is called A Bunch of Stuff.
Also going to get a new album from Ben Lee. It's called Ripe. It's his sixth release. Let's take a listen.
Your love got big, your jokes got worse each afternoon. Like bacon at a bar mitzvah, like a lead balloon. And who's to say what really happened in that room? Each day I was looking for a bride, you were looking for a groom.
That's Ben Lee. He should know from bar mitzvahs. You know, he's been making music since he was about 14.
Yeah.
I actually saw him in a great show called What I Like About Jew, where they played holiday songs around Christmas, Hanukkah songs.
Isn't he Australian or
he's,
something?
Well, he can be Jewish in Australia.
No, no, I just mean as an added fact.
Yes.
And dated Claire Danes, I think.
Yes, right. My favorite band is from your neck of the woods, your old hometown.
The all-girl,
hometown.
The all-girl California rockers. You know them as the Donnas.
Yourself together, 'cause I don't need you like you want me to. Gotta loosen up, drain the cup. It's time to tear it up. Well, I got one shot and the night is young.
Jesus. Like the love child. Like the love child of Joan Jett and
exactly.
Winger or something.
The name of the album is Bitchin', and it's their first indie release. They left their big label because they wanted to do it their way, which is how the Donna should always do it.
Absolutely. By the way, those songs, they may sound easy to play, but my little lame band in L.A. tried to cover one of their songs hard.
The Donnas are mean. They mean business. So that's it for New Music Tuesday. We do want to get to the final story of the Ramble. It's a farewell.
Three of our celebrities are permitted to assist here. Whom do you call on?
Brett. Admiral Byrd.
Byrd.
Is that a good answer?
I suppose, I don't know. Why are you looking like
that? That would be actress Brett Summers. She passed away on Saturday. She had roles in dozens of TV shows, including The Fugitive, Mary Tyler Moore Show. She was best known, though, as a celebrity panelist on the 1970s hit game show Match Game. She was a popular panelist because of her gravelly voice and her big sunglasses and her gift for making quips that always sounded kind of naughty. Although you didn't ever get them when you were a kid,
well,
right?
That's exactly. She always sounded like she smoked two packs of cigarettes before every show. And the news about Brett Summers reminds us all of the many hours of just happiness and chuckles we got as latchkey kids planted in front of the TV.
They had ashtrays. I was watching on YouTube. There was an ashtray right next to each microphone. That's how you know it was the 70s.
The double entendre just whizzing past our adolescent heads. So in honor of Ms. Summers, the BPP presents this tribute. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Bryant Park Project Match Game. And now, here's the host of the BPP Match Game, Mike Pesca.
Thank you, Allison. Woo! Thank you, Luke. I am now holding Gene Rayburn's memorial extended microphone. And let's introduce our celebrity panelists today. Today, we'll be playing with you, Allison Stewart.
Golf claps, come on.
Luke Burbank. Rachel Martin. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, guys.
And, okay, we ran out of celebrities, and Marshall Wallace wasn't in, and Artie Johnson, and the rest of the cast are laughing, and someone who did a two-second spot on The Fugitive. Dan Pashman's here.
Hey, guys. Right,
Dan's a producer for the Bryant Park Project. So to play the match game, we need some contestants, and I think we might have a couple with us. John Proffitt is a 36-year-old, either an IT guy or he's the IT guy.
He is the IT guy.
From Anchorage, Alaska. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So Clara Bow is the IT girl, and John, you're the IT guy. How you like being the IT guy?
Oh, it's great.
All right. Dennis Cook is a 51-year-old cook from Kremlin, Colorado. Hi, Dennis.
Hello.
How does the altitude affect how high you have to light the burners in Colorado?
Very high.
Very high? Okay. I don't want your cream brulee. Ho ho!
Oh my god.
Let's
you're taking
play
this way too
the match
seriously.
Game. Dennis?
Yes.
Your name's Dennis Flynn, right?
That's correct.
You are a cook.
I am a cook.
Okay. Dennis Cook is a Flynn. A Flynn is a medieval job, meaning one who shods sheep. All right, the first question is to John. John, you know how the game is played, correct?
I believe so.
You have to match our celebrity panelists. And John, keep it more suggestive than outright filthy, if you can. But if you can't, that's fine. Here's our first question. Pakistan's president, Pervez Musharraf, is so authoritarian. How
authoritarian is he?
Thank you. He's so authoritarian that when he invites you to dinner, he doesn't offer chicken or fish. He offers chicken or blank. Now, John, think on that as
what?
Our celebrity panelists try to fill in the blank. I'll say it again. Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf is so authoritarian, he doesn't offer you, when he invites you to dinner, he doesn't offer you chicken or fish. He offers you chicken or blank. And once you have your answer, I need all the panelists to say ding.
Ding.
Rachel?
Okay, ding.
All right. Yeah. John, are you ready with your answer?
I think so. I don't know how suggestive it is, but we'll try it out.
Okay, so here we go. Pervez Musharraf is so authoritarian, when he invites you to dinner, he doesn't offer chicken or fish. He offers chicken or...
elf.
Say again?
Chicken or elf.
Elf?
Elf?
It's an authoritarian sort of answer.
It's early. It's very early.
Pakistani elf.
No, or else.
Or else.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, that's funny.
Or else.
Let's turn those phones up. Or we're having
wow.
a lot of confusion on the show.
We're too
slow this morning.
I thought you had maybe gone Lord of the Rings on us. Gondor? Okay, let's see if we have any matches from our celebrity panel. Rachel Martin, for you first. Pervez Musharraf offers chicken or...
get your booty over here, kebab.
Oh, yeah. Some sort of kebab. Oh, Dan Pashman, Pervez Musharraf offers chicken or...
Chicken.
Allison Stewart, he offers chicken or...
Handcuffs,
ooh. Nice. Oh.
Said go naughty.
And Luke Burbank said he offers chicken or...
chicken or execution by firing squad.
We would have accepted any form of execution.
I think that counts as or else.
That
no,
might.
I can't. Come on
so,
now.
Ruling from the judges, he has won.
All right. You got a point. Good job there. By the way, that was a great answer. Or else. We like that. Or elf made no sense, but it went into a fun little area. Here's our next question. This is for Dennis Flynn, the cook. Hey, Dennis, you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, here's the question. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan has a new book. Now, I'm not saying Alan Greenspan is old, but when he started writing this book, the number one book on the bestseller list was blank. Oh, that's a long way around to this. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan has a new book. I'm not saying Greenspan is old, but when he started writing it, the number one book on the bestseller list was blank. Our celebrities are compiling their answers.
Ding.
We got one
ding.
Ding. Two dings.
Ding.
Pashman with his ding. All right, Dennis, what do you say? Here's the question. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan has a new book. I'm not saying Greenspan is old, but when he started writing it, the number one book on the bestseller list was...
The Old Testament.
All right, let's go around in order. Rachel Martin, the number one book back then was...
it's not really a match, but the Ten Commandments.
Part of the Old Testament, Judges?
We're going to give that.
All right. Yeah, I think we can give execution for else. You got to give that. Allison?
The Old Testament.
Old Testament.
Ooh.
Luke Burbank.
I said the Dead Sea Scrolls.
What do we
no,
say?
No.
All right.
A key part of the Old Testament.
I would think. Like
Cashman? I've got Genesis. The book
Turn
of
me
Genesis.
On again with Genesis. What do you say?
We're deliberating.
Okay, it's in the Bible.
Okay,
we're
saying yes.
All right. 3-1. We have time for
one more round.
All right, let's go again. Here's the next question. AOL is moving its corporate headquarters from Virginia to New York. So now, instead of hearing you've got mail, you'll hear you got blank. AOL is moving corporate headquarters from Virginia to New York, John Prophet. Instead of hearing you've got mail, it's now you've got
freaking mail.
Oh, I didn't answer yet.
Oh, Allison, pretend he didn't say that.
It was so good.
No. That's okay.
Ding.
Luck. Yeah.
Ding.
Let's ding in, guys. Let's go back to pre-John's answer.
Ding.
Wow, that really upsets the game. You jumped the gun, John. We'd have to. If this were being ruled by standards and practices, we would have to throw that out. But let's go around in order. Dan Pashman, it's not you've got mail, it's you got...
Roaches.
Roaches.
Oh, nice one. Nice.
Rachel Martin, you got...
You got a seven-figure rent. Thank you very much.
Someone, someone who lives near Al Pacino.
Allison Stewart.
You got skills.
Luke Burbank.
You got A.
Apparently Fonzie lives in New York and not Milwaukee.
Yeah, I realized how Fonzie that was when I
All right, no matches for you. And now here's the last question on our version of the match game. Wait till the celebrities answer, Dennis, as I pose this question to them. The Brian Park Project is a crazy, kooky kind of game show. When you donate to other NPR programs, you get a tote bag. The Brian Park Project gives you a blank bag.
A blank bag?
Oh, man.
You guys got to think. We'll do the Super 70s pan zoom camera angles.
Uh-oh.
Charles Nelson Reilly has...
I'm just wondering how quick the email will come from CEO Ken Stern for my answer. How quickly will it arrive in my inbox?
Not too filthy, ladies and gentlemen,
ding.
Please. Reluctant ding out of Rachel.
Wait, well, can you do it one more time,
yeah.
Michael?
The Brian Park Project, it's a crazy, kooky kind of radio show. When you donate to other NPR programs, you get a tote bag. The Brian Park Project gives you a blank bag.
I'm going for it, ding.
Okay.
What do we got? You got it. Luke and Dan, do you have your type of bag answered? Do we hear a ding out of you?
I'm struggling here, man.
That's okay. You don't have to come up with anything brilliant.
Judge calls time.
Patty Duke never did.
Judge called time.
Wow. Ding.
All right, ding.
All right.
All right, the question goes to you, Dennis Flynn, the cook from Colorado. The Brian Park Project. It's kooky. It's crazy. When you donate to other NPR programs, you get a tote bag. The Brian Park Project gives you a blank bag.
Plastic?
Plastic bag.
Oh,
that ain't bad.
That's nice.
Wait, the audience likes it. All right, Rachel, what kind of bag?
You get a Luke Burr bag.
Ooh.
Oh,
that's terrible.
That was a pun.
You know, punnery is the lowest form of comedy. Actually, it's tied with mime for the lowest form of comedy.
Wow.
Dan Pashman.
You get a pearl snapped tote bag.
Okay.
What?
A tote bag with pearl snaps.
All right, mine, you get a dime bag. Drugs are bad, drugs are bad, drugs are bad. Don't
she
do drugs.
She went there.
Wow.
Good. Drugs are bad, that's, just saying.
I love that, Allison, because that clears me on so much stuff I'm planning on saying on October 1st when we actually go on the real radio.
Luke Burbank, what kind of bag do you get?
Not, you know, this is kind of a letdown. I was going to say a hefty bag.
Hefty bag?
No.
That's good.
We're kind of, we're still the sort of not quite there financially.
All right, judges, what's the tally?
That is a plastic bag, actually.
Yeah, sure.
So we're going to go
all right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right.
1 point there. So 2 points for total points for John. 1 point. Dennis has 4. Dennis is our winner.
Yay.
Nice. Way to go, Dennis Flynn.
Do you know how tired this funk band is getting?
Same riff over and over.
They're incredibly consistent.
And let's announce what our winner gets. How about a mug? You want a mug? You got a mug. Can we give what time's it in Alaska, John?
It's about 4:30 a.m.
I mean, give the guy a mug too, can we?
Yeah, we'll get him something.
We'll get him something.
Yeah. We'll send it in a hefty bag.
All right, there's no chance to match Richard Dawson, but thanks for playing the Brian Park match game.
Wow, Mike Pesca, ladies and gentlemen. That was a sight to behold.
I'm feeling regular feature. I don't know about you guys.
I know.
On September 4th, a website called MarryOurDaughters.com made its debut. Now, if you're inclined, you could buy yourself a young bride. Its founder claims he's gotten tons of responses to ads that read a little bit like a J. Crew catalog. Here's one, for example. $24,995 can get you a proposal to 15-year-old Michaela, who, quote, was named after her grandmother and takes after her in a lot of ways. She's a traditional girl, a homebody who cooks like a chef and decorates like Martha Stewart. She also has a cheerful, upbeat look on life and spends a lot of time laughing. She is looking for a man with a sense of humor to take care of. Or you could bid, so to speak, on 13-year-old Courtney from the South, who, according to the site, Courtney's grandmother married at 13, her mother married at 13, and Courtney has decided she wants to keep the tradition going. She got an A in home ec and has read up on what else would be expected of her as a wife and is looking forward to it. Now, at this point, if you're asking yourself, is this for real, that is a good question.
Yeah.
Let's ask the founder. John Ordover. Ordover?
Ordover. Ordover.
Thank you. Is a creator of a site called MarryOurDaughter.com. Is it real, John, your site?
It is a real site.
Is it? Can you buy these teenage brides for real?
No. And in fact, the way the site is set up, and let me speak for a moment as if it were real. In the persona I take on, what does that say? It is not bidding. It is not an auction. Each girl collects a bunch of proposals that have pre-agreed to that bride price.
Mm-hmm.
And then the family goes through those and picks out, like, out of 20 or 30 or however many, however many men they actually want to meet and talk to and discuss the things with, and then work it out eventually over a period of time. So it's not eBay. You can't bid. You can't outbid another bidder. And you certainly can't click the buy it now button and get a big UPS box with air holes punched in the side a few days later.
So it's the girl's choice of all the different proposals she gets.
It's the family's choice.
Let's start that. If this were real.
And now I think we're going to leave the part of the interview where you pretend it's real and start talking about the fact that it's not real.
Okay.
Where did you get the idea for this website? What is the point of this?
The point of this is that while the website is not real, everything on it is legal. And that people tend to be complacent about this issue because they think the age of consent is also the age of marriage, which it is not. For example, in Texas, the age of consent is 17, but the age of where you can get married with your parents' permission is 14.
13 in New Hampshire, right?
And 13 in New Hampshire. And the Texas law is great. And also in Utah, you don't need your parents' permission to get married at 14 if you've been married before.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
And also, there are many, many states who have pregnancy exceptions, which is that
wedding exception,
exactly.
Basically?
There is no age too young if you're pregnant, which at the time was a protection, but now is knock her up and you can marry her.
So now your job is you're a viral marketer.
Right.
So you got involved in this, according to the research I've done, almost as a charitable thing. You were talking to a group of women who had been in a similar situation.
A group sounds like it's much larger than it is. It was really like one woman and three or four of her friends. But I ran into a party. The discussion came up because of the whole stuff that's going on in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked
the Warren Jeffs trial.
The Warren Jeffs trial. And I said, basically, well, at least it could never happen around here. It's only Utah. And this woman got really quiet. And then she said, it happened to me. And I live around here.
Wow.
That's how I got interested in it. And for using, you know, at some point you get tired of selling horses and handbags and you want to do some good. So I got involved with this.
We're going to ask you to stick around for just a moment. We need to take a quick break. We're talking to John Ordover.
Ordover.
Ordover. I keep doing that. I'm so sorry. John Ordover, the creator of the website MarryOurDaughter.com, to discuss a little further the age of marriage and how low it goes in this country. So, John, stick around for a minute.
Coming up in a moment, too, we're going to talk about copper theft in the U.S., a way bigger deal than you might have even imagined, and lots more. That's coming up in just a few moments on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart, along with my partner in crime, Luke Burbank. And we're continuing our conversation about the website Marry Our Daughter. Its creator, John Ortover, is here with us. Now, this website is a hoax. We do want to say that up front. But people who went to this website and agreed to these prices for these teenage girls, they obviously didn't know it was a hoax at the time. Can you describe some of the proposals that you got from men who thought, I'd like to have a 14-year-old bride?
They were just – it's one of those things that would be absolutely appropriate. It's a proposal. It's a love letter. It's some of them are actually very sweet and sincere sounding, although I can never tell if they're just jerking my chain.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem is the context. If someone had been writing that letter to – if they were 30 and writing it to a 30-year-old, it would be sweet. Because it's written to a 13-year-old, it comes off as kind of creepy.
Yeah.
What's interesting is everybody has this image in their head that it's like 40, 50-year-old
creepy guys in a basement somewhere.
Yeah, but what I found to the extent that I've been able to go through the thousands of proposals and thousands of sign-ups, most of them are just telling me to go jump. They tend to be 20-year-old, not 20-year-old, but 20s. They're in their 20s. They're a computer geek. They're making a hell of a lot of money, but they have no knowledge whatsoever about how to ask a girl out.
No social skills. Right. Network at all.
Yes. And some of them sound actually really very sweet. But again, and some of the 20-year-olds were only proposing to like the 17 or about to be 18-year-old. So that's actually not all that creepy to me. But yeah, there were a lot of guys trying to pick up Michaela or Courtney.
Now, you're coming out today, and you're going to reveal that the website is indeed a hoax,
yes.
Which, of course, leads to the next question. How do we know that you're not yanking our chain right now? And there wasn't a few women who told you this story, and there haven't been as many proposals as you've said.
Well, I'll be happy to let you into my Gmail, but I got to tell you this. If I wanted to hoax you, I could have showed up with a woman. I could have found an actress or a friend who would come in here and lie as smoothly as she can talk. I have too many friends who are like that.
Yeah.
So if I were actually trying to hoax you, I would carry through on the hoax. I wouldn't say no, I'm not allowed to bring one in. I would bring one.
And we have to say that we did do a lot of research about many of the claims that you make about the age of consent versus the age of marriage, and everything did pan out. So you are serious about just trying to raise awareness.
I call this viral politics. Mm-hmm. I call it, to some extent, the politics of outrage. Because it's under NPR, I can use the phrase reductio ad absurdum. You take what's actually there and you take it to the nth level. And once people see what's actually possible, then they start reacting to it. What I did when I went on various shock jock shows as Roger Mandervan,
yes,
the publicity director.
You took a whole other persona
right.
as the publicity director of this website.
Right. What I did was I defended it to the hilt. I told them why it was valid. I told them what was good. And then people would get upset, or the disc jockeys would yell at me, or the callers would yell at me. And I would say, well, it's a legal service. And if you don't like it, change the law. Call your governor. Call the legislature. Tell them to change the law.
And thereby making your political point.
Right.
All right. You know what? I'd love to check back with you in a couple of weeks to see how this works out for you once you go public that the site is a hoax. And I'd love to hear some of the response you get.
Well, a lot of people who've penetrated the hoax seem to like that it was a hoax. Right. They prefer it that way.
All right. John Ortover. Ortover. Thank you. Ortover. Thanks for coming into the studio today.
You're
very really
welcome.
Appreciate it.
No problem.
I noticed that some of the brides were listed at like X number of thousands and $995 for the
that's marketing of
for
it.
The price conscious
yes.
person who wants a child bride. Well, thank you, John, for coming by. Coming up, we're going to talk about stealing copper, something that's kind of becoming a larger and larger problem here in the U.S. And lots of other stuff. First, though, we need to check today's news headlines from Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. There's more fallout in the expulsion of a U.S. security firm from Iraq. Iraq's government says it will review the status of all security companies working in the country after a shooting incident involving guards from the U.S. company Blackwater USA. At least 9 civilians were killed when Blackwater contractors allegedly opened fire after mortar rounds landed near their convoy. According to U.S. officials, the Blackwater guards were escorting a State Department convoy at the time. Blackwater officials say their guards acted lawfully and appropriately to the attack, but the government of Iraq says they want Blackwater out of the country, and it plans to prosecute those involved. But as you heard earlier in the show, it's unclear what kind of jurisdiction the Iraqi government has over the U.S. security firm. So yesterday, we told you that Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf has agreed to quit his job as chief of the army before federal elections next month. But today, a government lawyer has said Musharraf will only hand in his general's uniform after he's reelected as president. Musharraf has held both jobs, president and chief of the army, since 1999 when he took control of the country in a military coup. He's faced mounting political pressure to step down from his military post. But opponents, including former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, are now condemning the announcement as unconstitutional and undemocratic. They want Musharraf to surrender his military position before elections. And embattled Republican Senator Larry Craig is getting support from an unlikely ally. The American Civil Liberties Union this week filed a court brief saying the Idaho lawmaker's bathroom arrest was likely unconstitutional. Craig was arrested in June at the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport after a police officer in a bathroom stall next to him alleged that the senator attempted to solicit him for sex. Craig pleaded guilty in early August to one charge of disorderly conduct and announced his intention to resign from the Senate September 30th. But days later, Craig announced he would fight to overturn his conviction and may not resign. The ACLU has urged a Minneapolis court to let Craig withdraw his guilty plea. Senator Craig has been a strong supporter of a federal constitutional amendment banning gay marriage, something the ACLU has staunchly opposed. And America Online, you know them, you've got mail and all that. Well, the company is moving to the big city. After calling Northern Virginia home base for more than 20 years, the internet provider announced plans yesterday to shift its headquarters to New York City. AOL is stepping up its efforts to transform itself from internet provider into advertising empire, and moving to New York will put the company smack dab in the middle of the country's advertising hub. And moving on to Monday Night Football, here's a recap of what happened. The Washington Redskins beat the Philadelphia Eagles 20-12 in Philadelphia. The Skins quarterback Jason Campbell hit Chris Cooley for one touchdown, and running back Clinton Portis ran it in for another. Add in two field goals from Sean Swisham, and it was too much for the Eagles to handle. They just couldn't
Why do you even do the sports?
The end zone.
Why do you even do it?
Because it's important to some people. Okay. And we try to be a full-service news
operation.
Okay,
no, I, that's a good point. Thank
I know. I watch it sometimes, and it's clearly
the sports
revealed.
The sports.
I watched the sport. I watched the athletic competitions sometimes.
That was a good football match. Fellas, all right.
The news and some sports are always online at NPR.org. I'm Rachel Martin. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
Thank you so much, Rachel. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the sports, a high school football game in Scottsdale, Arizona was canceled last weekend after they couldn't get the field lights to turn on. An investigation quickly discovered the culprit. Someone had stolen the copper wiring that ran to the lights.
So no Friday night lights, literally. No,
yeah, and that's low down. Come on. After we learned here at the BPP, after a little digging, copper theft is actually becoming a sort of big problem in the U.S. The root causes appear to be a Chinese building boom and crystal meth addiction in the U.S. Those two again. At it again. Scott Baronito is the executive editor of CSO Magazine, a trade publication for security executives. He wrote a great article called Red Gold Rush about copper theft, which if you go to csoonline.com, you can check out. I highly recommend it. Scott, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks. My pleasure.
So how big of a problem really is this copper theft?
Well, it's difficult to say in terms of numbers how big the problem is because it's sort of a million little thefts rather than a few large heists. But certainly if you talk to the security executives at utilities, they consider this a bigger problem than terrorism, frankly.
Really?
It is their single biggest problem they deal with day to day.
Can somebody really get a lot of money or even enough money to make it worth it? It seems like quite a process to sort of go and steal the stuff and I guess they melt off the outside wire sometime.
That's right. It is quite a process. But with the prices as high as they are now, and right now they're tracking at about $3.44 a pound, which is historically unbelievably high, that you can steal a few hundred pounds of copper and make quite a bit of money if you have a sort of a drug problem to get your next hit.
Is this a yank and grab and gutters off of buildings, or is this the kind of thing where people are going onto construction sites with personas and pretending to be in the part of the crew and walking off with
It's actually
materials.
Both. A lot of the worst ones are the yank and grabs, and the stories are unbelievable you hear because people will go to great lengths to find the copper and then take it. You know, they'll get blow torches and cut up rail lines. They'll climb utility poles and cut live wires. They'll steal roofs off of churches have been stolen. They'll go into houses and take the live plumbing out. On the other hand, you know, an equal problem is when you're at a construction site, you have a lot of subcontractors around. If you leave those big spools of wires you see on construction sites laying there, they're going to be gone the next day if you don't have them locked up.
How much money can someone get for, you know, let's just say an average, you know, meth person who wants to try to get – they grab a few pipes and take it down to the place. Are we talking $5, $100? Do you have to get a giant amount of it for it to be a sizable amount of money?
You have to get, you know, several pounds anyway. It depends on how much money you're looking for. Usually they're trying to steal a few hundred pounds of it if they can. Sometimes if they're in desperate straits, they'll steal just as much as they can, even if it's 20 pounds, and try to pawn it off at the local scrapyard.
So what's the – I mean, what's the effect this has to people like me that aren't in construction?
Well, the effects are pretty widespread. First of all, there's the public safety issue. When people are climbing poles and cutting live wires and those live wires are left dangling, that's a big problem. When you cut the wires and power goes out, that's also a big problem. In Detroit, what happened was some unexperienced metal thieves went up and cut some lines and realized they were fiber optic and took out 911 service in Detroit for a while.
Jeez.
And then there's the cost problem. Say you want to take the wires out of a light pole or the lights at that field in Arizona, which is a very typical metal theft story. Usually it's a yank and grab. You'll tear the pole down or you'll try to open it up somehow and you'll rip the wires out. You may get $300 of copper out of that pole, but you've left a $1,500, $2,000, $2,500 repair job behind, and usually the taxpayers end up paying for that.
How does China factor into this?
Well, China, virtually overnight in the early 2000s, became the biggest consumer of the base metals, aluminum, copper, zinc, and nickel, just through its building boom right now. There's a massive building boom going on over there. And what happened was China just started buying up as much copper and other metals as it could, both because it needed it and also because they were trying to store it up in case prices got too high even for them. And it seemed no matter how high the prices went, China just kept buying and buying and buying. To give you a sense, around the time just after 9/11, copper was pretty stagnant and at about 65 cents a pound. And by May of 06, it peaked at, some say, $3.99 a pound, or some say $4.04 a pound. So you're talking about a 500% increase in value.
Well, the law of supply and demand in effect.
Yeah.
That's right, and there were a couple of natural disasters. There was a landslide, which affected production of copper, and then there was a strike at a mine in Chile, which is the world's biggest producer of copper, which also affected supply production. And we ended up in what's called a deficit condition, which means that we were eating up much more copper than we were producing, which exacerbates the effect on the prices.
Well, Scott Baronito, it's a great article that you wrote in CSO. It's I wouldn't have imagined CSO magazine to be a place to get a such detailed sort of description of the scene and the smell of these wires being burned. But it's a great piece, and we'll link to it on our website. People should definitely take a look at it.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. Boy, I don't know. This NPR racket may not be where it's at. We need to get stealing copper. Thank you, Scott.
Although I have to say I did a little ring up on it and five people died recently trying to do this. Obviously, yeah, they probably were on the drugs maybe. Hey, so unions fighting with the man. It's a story as old as time and to some as boring. This is where we step in. On today's edition of Make Me Care, we look at the negotiations between General Motors, the man, and its workers, the UAW. The subject at hand is pay, benefits, and the machinist's health care plan. Stepping up to the plate to make us care is NPR's Frank Langfitt. He reports on labor and workplace issues, and he's holed up in a hotel in Detroit where the negotiations are taking place. You are on the ground there, Frank. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Can I get a little background from you about this? The negotiations have been going on for 5 days now or so. One session, most recent, went to 3 a.m. What seems to be the sticking point right now?
Well, the stakes are actually really high here, higher than they've probably been in decades. So in a sense, this is different. It's like $50 billion in health care for retirees, hundreds of thousands of retirees. And the question is, who's going to take responsibility for that? The company wants out. And what they want to do is put this money in a health care trust fund and give it to the union to run and basically say, you know, it's your problem. And the real question is how much money they're going to put in the trust fund. Like, they'd like to put 65 cents on the dollar, something like that. Of course, the union wants more because health care keeps going up in terms of price. And what the union's looking for is it wants a company like to commit to new products in the U.S. because they don't want to see more stuff go to Mexico, and they need to come back to their workers with something saying, you know, we got some jobs for you.
All right. So, Frank, with that in mind, everybody, we're putting 60 seconds on the Make Me Care clock. I'm counting it down in 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. Frank, make me care about this negotiation.
Allison, this is not the same old story. This is like about fundamental change, huge changes and changes in our society. You got like killer healthcare costs, you got global competition, and you've got companies shifting risks to workers. It's something that all of us, including you and me, we've probably been feeling for 20 years in journalism, paying higher premiums, stuff like that. And it doesn't just affect like some 60-year-old production worker in Flint. I mean, this is happening to white-collar workers as well. You know, you've got well-educated software engineers up in the Northwest. They're seeing jobs going to India. They're wondering, like, what am I going to do? You know, just a couple weeks ago, government showed that 2 million more people had gone without health care insurance in this country. And my wife, she's a veterinarian, she's waiting to get her teeth fixed right now because she can't find a good dentist in our HMO. So the idea that this is just about like some old blue-collar workers in the Midwest, I think is wrong. It's about really, really big trends that are affecting all of us.
He did it with 5 seconds
to
go.
He brought in the Northwest.
Got it personal with us.
Yeah.
Brought in the family as well.
Frank, I don't want to swell your head, but that may have been one of the better Make Me Cares I've actually heard.
I agree.
Well, I've been thinking about it for a while because I know, Luke, you talked to me about this Make Me Care stuff, and I kind of agree. Like, sometimes as reporters, we get our heads really deep in the story, and we don't step back and say, actually, this isn't just about, like, the details. It's actually about, like, these huge trends that we all kind of feel day to day, but maybe we don't connect the dots.
So, Frank, just do a little bit of housekeeping for me. Tell me what's in the future. Are they going back to the negotiating table today?
Going back today, and it's probably going to take quite some time. I mean, this is, you know, for the union, this is really kind of risky in a sense because they're going to take over this responsibility. And instead of, you know, as you were saying in the beginning, instead of, like, being representative for the workers, they're going to be the man now. Hmm. And if they start running out of money in this healthcare trend, they have to turn down to the workers and say, you know, I'm going to have to raise your premiums.
Yeah, we don't have you covered. Then.
I'm going to have to raise your copays.
Yeah.
And workers are going to say, like, well, now you're the man. And so in union world, that's like a huge shift in relationship.
Frank Langfitt reports on labor and workplace issues for NPR. Thanks for playing Make Me Care. Good luck out there in Detroit.
Thanks, Allison.
Awesome job, Frank. Okay, this was my little thing I got into the show today. We had new music. Chamillionaire, one of my favorites. He's got a new song out and a new record. This is Hip Hop Police. Slick Rick is on there, and let's just let's pump up the jam this morning on the Bryant Park Project.
This takes us out. Thanks for spending your day with us. We'll be back tomorrow. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Somebody tell them it's murder. Murder was the case, and they blame me. Officer, I didn't do it. You can't blame me for this. Could you please loosen up the handcuffs on my wrist? You can call me what you want to, man, but I ain't a snitch. No cooperation, it's exactly what you would get. Till I talk to my lawyer, you get no reply. You've obviously been watching too much CSI. I'm not a crash dummy, so don't even try to talk your dirty trash to me. No BFI. If you are not guilty of anything, then why did you run? Cause you the police, and plus I saw you cocking your gun. And the chamber wasn't empty, it was obviously one. If you think I'm believing that one, then you're obviously dumb.